roll your sleeves up, maybe grab your pencil. We're going to dig a little bit. We're going to stay here in Matthew 24, but it's going to get kind of academic up in here. I hope you'll go with me on the journey here. We're going to talk about, as David alluded to the discussion, we're talking about Matthew 24. And entitled the sermon, Rightly Dividing Matthew 24. You may recognize that. Some of you younger folks, the more modern English translations translate a phrase from 2 Timothy 2 and verse 15 that says handling aright the word of God. But those of us who grew up listening to King James, we heard it said rightly dividing the word of truth. And certainly when you think about Matthew 24, some things we're going to talk about tonight, rightly dividing seems to be very appropriate to the passage at hand. And that's what I want us to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about something that sometimes is referred to as the Mount Olivet Discourse. It's a conversation, really, as the reading showed us, that Jesus has with his apostles on the Mount of Olives about things concerning, of which this picture behind me is, if you recognize that, it's stones of the temple. That's rubble. That's what's left of the Jewish second temple, Herod's temple, that was destroyed by the Roman army commanded by Titus in AD 70. That's what's left of it, those stones. And certainly that historical event, the Roman siege and assault on Jerusalem in AD 70, is prominently featured in the discourse that we're going to study tonight. But as you think about Matthew chapter 24, maybe you've thought about it previously, or maybe you haven't thought about it previously. But as we work through the text here, this is a lesson with an agenda. We want to understand what's being said in Matthew 24. And when you study Matthew 24, two of the questions you often come away with are these. Is Jesus talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, a historic event that we've already alluded to and you've seen some of the evidence of? Or the question to be asked, was he talking about his second coming at the end of time? And maybe you've pondered those questions before. Maybe you've not pondered those questions before. And if you haven't, you're probably at least now pondering this question. You might ask, well, why does that matter? And let me just give you a couple reasons or some things to think about before we dive into Matthew 24. There are some that say Jesus is only talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. So we come back to the question, well, why does that matter? Well, let me suggest to you that if you've heard the phrase realize eschatology or study the end times, it realize means it's already happened. Or perhaps you've heard the more common phrase, the 70 A.D. doctrine, the A.D. 70 doctrine. This is a belief that teaches that all Bible prophecy, including everything we're going to study and look at tonight in Matthew 24, was fulfilled in the destruction of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. The idea then is everything in Matthew 24 has already happened. And if you extend that a little bit, what that means is if all Bible prophecy was fulfilled in AD 70, that includes all Bible prophecy. It includes the resurrection of the dead, the second coming of Christ, and the universal judgment of all men have already taken place. And that's again known as the AD 70 doctrine. And again, behind that is the understanding that everything in Matthew 24 has already happened. Let me suggest to you as well, there are some that say here in Matthew 24, Jesus is talking about and only talking about his second coming at the end of time. So the next question follows, well, why does that matter? And perhaps you're familiar with the teaching, the idea of premillennialism, that idea that we're living in a period pre or before a 1,000-year reign on earth by Jesus in a kingdom in modern-day Jerusalem, in a city of Jerusalem. So those then have the exact opposite perspective. They say nothing in Matthew 24 has happened yet. And because of that, then they can look at Matthew 24 and they see it as kind of a play-by-play description of what's going to happen. Therefore, you can look at least the nature, the types of things that are talked about in Matthew 24, compare that to what's going on and have an idea of at least the general time when the Lord will return. And you hear and see things that indicate people look around at the socio-political climate in our world today and say, oh, see, the end is near. And they'll think this is the back of the book coming true. That's where this idea comes from. But again, once they think they know when Jesus comes back, it's what they think Jesus is going to do, that then he will establish a kingdom for that 1,000-year reign. And even if you haven't heard the term premillennialism, this is the world view, the theological view that's behind a lot of the things you do hear about, discussed among religious people, ideas of a future literal fulfillment of a battle of Armageddon, terms like the rapture, this idea of reading the book of Revelation with a future look that none of it's happened yet. And so this lends itself not only to theological discussions and debates, but even socio-political issues are impacted by this. People will talk about the U.S. foreign policy with modern nation state of Israel in terms of a worldview around this idea of premillennialism. You hear things, stories about looking for the signs like Russian tanks surrounding Jerusalem and Vladimir Putin and all these things brought into these discussions because of this view, part of it which comes from a certain perspective on Matthew 24, that none of this has happened yet. But ultimately, let me suggest to you the biggest problem with this view is that it denies that Christ now reigns. A king with a kingdom. So that's why we want to understand what Jesus is talking about in Matthew 24. Let me suggest to you as we begin here, there are, I think, some keys to understanding this discourse. And these are some things we need to go ahead and cover right up front and then remember as we move through the rest of the chapter. And the first one is Jesus describes an event to happen in the apostles' lifetime. If you look there at verse 34, I think verse 34 is a key timestamp for this text. Jesus says in verse 34, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place." Similarly, Jesus describes in Matthew 24 an event preceded by perceptible signs. It's clear in some of the things he says, specifically in verse 15, he tells those listening to him, "Therefore, when you see." And it's important that they do see, they do perceive, because he says there are some instructions. When you see, there's some things you need to do. When you see, it's time to flee. And also in verse 33, underscores this idea again. He tells them, when you see all these things, then you better recognize. So clearly Jesus is talking about an event that's going to be preceded by perceptible signs. But it's also true that here in Matthew 24, Jesus also describes an event with no perceptible signs. And here's where you may want to circle verse 36. Because here Jesus says, "But of that day and hour, no one knows. Not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone." So I think right off the bat, we can see it'd be hard to imagine a single event that can be described both as "watch for these signs that tell you it is going to happen," and Jesus say, "I don't even know when it's going to happen." Let's think about these things. These, again, you have a time stamp. You have some details about perceptible signs that you will see, and a reminder that part of what I'm talking about will have no perceptible signs as we move through Matthew 24. Begins there, as David read for us, Jesus having this lament over Jerusalem there at the end of chapter 23, and even saying, "You will be left desolate," as he cries over Jerusalem. And we pick up the narrative in chapter 24, verse 1. Jesus comes out of the temple, was going away when his disciples came up to him, and he said, "Look at these temple buildings." And Jesus says, "Do you not see all things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another which will not be torn down." And then verse 2 begins by saying, as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives. And this is one of those places where sometimes the brevity of the biblical narrative we miss just a little bit. If you know anything about the geography of Jerusalem, you understand that the temple set on what was referred to as the Temple Mount. So Jesus, as he left the temple, that hill on which the temple set in the city of Jerusalem, to get to the Mount of Olives, he would have had to have descended that hill down off of the Temple Mount, come down into what's called the Kidron Valley. At the very bottom of the Kidron Valley, he would have crossed the Brook of Kidron. And then he would have started up the opposite slope up onto the Mount of Olives. And as Jesus and his apostles ascended that Mount of Olives, when it got to a place he wanted to stop, they would have stopped and sat down on the slope, turning back toward Jerusalem. And their view would have been something like this. And this is a photograph Leon Maldon took from the Mount of Olives back toward the Temple Mount. Now, some of you already recognize the most prominent building, that golden dome you see there, is the Dome of the Rock. the third most important religious site in Islam, behind Mecca and Medina, which currently occupies the spot on the Temple Mount where the temple once stood. So just as prominently as the Dome of the Rock figures in that photograph, as Jesus and his apostles were sitting on the Mount of Olives, looking back at Jerusalem, that's where the temple would have sat. That temple would have been his PowerPoint, if you will, to this discussion. That's what they would have been looking at when his disciples now come back to him and come to him privately. And basically, as they were leaving the temple, Jesus said what he said there in the red letters in verse 2. And now, after they've had that time that walk down or walk back up to think about it, they're sitting down. Now they come back to him privately, and basically they're saying, Jesus, we want to understand what you were saying over there previously. Tell us, when will these things happen? And what will the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And what we see here from the question, really it's two questions and an assumption that seem to be clear from what they say to Jesus about this. First, they do ask, tell us, when will these things happen? Again, talking about Jesus saying that one time the stone won't be left on top of another, and talking about the physical destruction of the temple. And so what they're really asking then is, when will this temple be reduced to just a pile of stones? But they also ask, what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? And so not only do we want to know when this is going to happen, they want to know, well, how are we going to know that this is about to happen? That seemingly is the kind of the gist of the two questions that they asked Jesus about this. But built into their questions, I think, is this assumption. Based on the way they asked their questions, you see their assumption is that this is all going to happen at the same time. And that's even clearer if you look at the other gospel accounts of this exchange between Jesus and the men here, particularly maybe Mark's account, Mark chapter 13 and verse 4, they kind of lump all that together and they simply say, tell us, when will these things be and what will be the sign of all these things are going to be fulfilled? They just simply refer to all of this as these things in Mark's account. And I think you see that their assumption is that, oh, this is going to happen all at the same time. I think it's perfectly logical to think then that these Jewish men would have that assumption. From their perspective, it's hard to imagine that the temple there, the house is where God dwells, it represents God's dwelling place among his people, that if that is ever destroyed, it's only going to be destroyed by God and only at the end of the world when all this comes to an end. So I think they assume that, not yet understanding the spiritual nature of the Messianic kingdom. And certainly we know from other study that the disciples struggled with that, understanding that it was going to be a spiritual kingdom. And if they didn't understand the kingdom was going to be spiritual, it's not hard to imagine they didn't understand that the temple would then be spiritual under the Messiah. So let me suggest to you then that they ask this question, not knowing that it's two questions, I don't believe, but I think we'll see that Jesus' answer separates these two events. And if you want to pick up the narrative, verses 4 through 8, kind of scan down there ahead, and you see what Jesus says. And basically he says, you want to know when this is going to happen? Let me tell you first, there's some things that aren't going to be signs that it's going to be going to happen. First, beware of these misleading signs. First, you're going to be concerned about false messiahs. There are going to be those that come and make claims to be me. We don't have to wonder whether that happened or not historically. Josephus records that there were many who, pretending to divine inspiration, he says, deceived the people. Josephus, a Roman Jewish historian of the time. Jesus says there will be wars and rumors of wars, and just like it is today, really, in first century Rome, in the time of the Roman Empire, there are always wars or rumors of wars. And Jesus didn't want them to think that every time they heard something like that, that meant that what I said was going to happen was about to happen. He also talked about natural disasters. Your version will mention famine or pestilence or something like that. That's going to happen. And again, you can see that these men, knowing that something cataclysmic is coming, might have taken these things as signs that Jesus not been more specific. And I think it's interesting that he specifically mentions earthquakes as these misleading signs, because you can dig a little bit and you find out that, in fact, in the 25 years preceding the destruction of the temple in AD 70, there are at least these five major earthquakes that happened in the Roman Empire that historians have noticed. So certainly earthquakes would have been one of those things that was prominent in the years leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem. And what Jesus says is, I've told you something's going to happen, and I want you to know these are signs, but these aren't the signs that's going to happen. Don't be misled, because when these things happen, they're merely the beginning of birth pangs. And Jesus goes on to tell them in verses 9 through 14, I got some bad news for you, fellas. And in addition to those kind of disasters and things like that, I told you that will be signs, the future holds tribulation for the faithful. And he begins to talk about how things are going to work out for them and for the faithful. And he says, you'll be delivered to authorities and hated and killed for my name. And you already know, you don't have to read very far into the book of Acts to see that happen. He says that many will fall away. And as you think about previous New Testament study, maybe the name Demas comes to mind. And that there will be those that fall away. He warns of false prophets that will arise and mislead many. Maybe you recall that Paul, writing the Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians 11, warned them about false apostles and deceitful workers who fashioned themselves as apostles of Christ. And ultimately, Jesus says, most people's love will grow cold. And at one point, Paul wrote Timothy in 2 Timothy 1:15 and said, this you know, that all that are in Asia turned away from me. Jesus also adds as a sign of, and something that's just going to be seen, is that the gospel of the kingdom will be spread to the whole world. And this is really one of the stumbling points, because when you read that phrase and that idea, probably the most natural reaction is to assume the whole world means every inch of earth, every inch of ground on the whole celestial ball that is the planet of earth. And that's one of the stumbling blocks people have. I think they read it and they assign that definition to it. And that's why some people say, well, this couldn't have happened yet, because the gospel hasn't gone everywhere. And that's why we have missionaries and we're doing these things. And once we do that, then Jesus will come back. And you hear those kind of things. Let me suggest to you the more natural understanding of Jesus when he says the whole world is the same one that the apostles used. Really, what we'd understand that is the inhabited Roman world of the first century, the Mediterranean world. And that's the understanding Paul used, and that's why Paul was able to say in Colossians 1 and verse 23, the gospel that you have heard, which was proclaimed in all creation under heaven. And Paul was able to pen those words in about 63 A.D. Then that these things would have been accomplished. And Jesus goes on to say there in chapter 24, and then the end shall come. One of the most interesting verses there, now if you look at verse 15, again, Jesus talking about signs. And he says, when you see the sign of Daniel. In verse 15, it says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, then I think Matthew adds this parenthetical statement, let the reader understand. Jesus refers to the sign of Daniel the prophet. He uses the term the abomination of desolation. And we don't have time for an in-depth study of Daniel, but let me tell you, there's twice in the book of Daniel that Daniel uses those words. Once in chapter 11, which is, if you're studying the narrative of Daniel, you'll believe that you'll come to understand that's a reference to Antiochus or Antiochus the Fourth. This is going to be a real geeky sentence here, so. But Antiochus Epiphanes, in the time the temple was desecrated in the intertestament period, just previous to the Maccabean revolt, the Maccabean war. I'll explain all that to you later. So that's not what he's talking about. But in Daniel chapter 12 and verse 11, where he uses the term the abomination of desolation, there are only two verses from the end of the book. Daniel's looking backwards and uses that as a summary statement for the destruction of the temple, the desecration of the holy place brought about by those Roman forces, the forces of that fourth world power that Daniel's been prophesying about really since Daniel chapter 2. You may recall from previous study that beginning in Daniel chapter 9, Daniel has this great prayer of national repentance. Daniel understands that the 70 years of captivity is about to come to end, and he prays to God, repenting for his people. And as part of his prayer, Daniel asks, and what will be the future? What will be the end of your people and your city? Daniel asks about the ultimate historical end of the Jews and of Jerusalem. And the answer comes back to him at the end of chapter 9 in what's known as the vision of the 70 weeks. And part of that in Daniel 9 and 27, talking about the people of the prince, the powers of Rome at this time will come upon Jerusalem, and it's described this way. It says, on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed. And in chapters 10 and 11 from the book of Daniel, really take this vision of 70 weeks that gets just a few verses into chapter 9, and then chapters 10 and 11 and into 12, flesh that out. And Daniel's chapter 10 and 11 are a blow-by-blow account of the history of God's people in Jerusalem on the years between their return from captivity and the destruction of Jerusalem by the Roman forces. Play-by-play of the conflicts between the Seleucids in the north and the Ptolemies in Egypt, with Jerusalem right in the middle, until this third king arises from the west, and it's clearly a reference to Rome. And as chapter 11 of the book of Daniel closes, we find those forces of the Roman king encamped between the sea and the beautiful holy mountain. The tents of a Roman army pictured between the Mediterranean and Jerusalem. And then chapter 12 begins with this verse. At that time, once the Roman forces are seen there encamped between the sea and Jerusalem, there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And that phrase you're going to see, very similar to one Jesus uses right here in context. But the second phrase here in 12 verse 1, I want you to take this and follow this away for just a few minutes from now. Daniel's also told everyone who is found written in the book will be rescued. So all that to say this about Jesus' use of Daniel, this idea of the abomination of desolation. What we learn here is from verse 15, Jesus says, based on what I say in verse 15, you need to be ready to do what's in verse 16. Look at verse 16. He says, then let those who are in Judea flee from the mountains. So this abomination of desolation, when you see that, flee from the mountains. Our analysis of the book of Daniel has led us to believe, conclude that when he says the abomination of desolation, he's talking about these pagan, idolatrous military forces coming into Jerusalem and destroying the temple, standing in the holy place. And we've concluded by comparing Daniel to Matthew here that Jesus is talking about when you see the Roman army coming down on Jerusalem. That's what I'm talking about. That's when you need to flee to the mountains. Let me just suggest to you that I think Luke confirms our understanding of this passage. In his parallel passage, Luke says this: when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near, and then you must flee to the mountains. So the sign of Daniel is that Roman army encompassing Jerusalem. And then Jesus tells these men, listen, when you see that, flee to the mountains. And as you survey again verses 16 through 22, and you read down through those verses, look at the great haste that's talked about in the literal escape of an advancing military force that's coming to siege and then assault your city. He says, when you see this, you flee to the mountains. You don't let anything slow you down. If you're up on the ceiling or the roof and you see this, don't stop to pack. You get going. If you're out in the field and you look and you see the time is coming, don't bother going back to the house. You just keep going. And when you think about a literal interpretation of this, that's why he would say it's going to be terrible when that day comes if you're pregnant, if you're trying to take small children with you, when you're fleeing from an approaching army. And when you think about the need to quickly get out of a city that's about to be assaulted, you can understand why Jesus says, pray that this doesn't happen in winter or on a Sabbath. You know, leaving in such a hurry, you can't take your coat. It just gets that much worse in the wintertime, doesn't it? Travel is always harder in the wintertime. Be extreme cold temperatures, maybe snow in the mountains. That would make it tough. If you live in a city like Jerusalem, that's a Jewish city, and you try to do this on a Sabbath, the odds are the laws of that Jewish community, maybe some gates were closed, the streets would be empty and dead because they would be observing the Sabbath. You would draw attention yourself, maybe into obstacles, but doing it on the Sabbath, it would just be harder to get up and get out of the city on a day when traveling was prohibited by the law of Moses. And Jesus again says, reminiscent of what we read from Daniel, it's going to be worse than anything that ever happened. In fact, he says, if not for divine compassion, none would survive, talking about the siege of Jerusalem. And it was bad. And I don't know, we could have a whole sermon just on some of the notes and things historians talk about the conditions inside Jerusalem during the siege and just before it fell. Even cannibalism and things that, how bad things got in Jerusalem. But luckily there was divine compassion. And Jesus will say, but for the elect's sake, the days will be cut short. Do you remember we looked at in Daniel 12, we mentioned that Daniel was told that everyone who is found written in the book will be rescued. When you study the siege of Jerusalem in AD 70, Adam Clark in his commentary on Matthew 24:16, he includes historical accounts of Christians, those whose names are written in the book, actually remembering what Jesus had said here and getting out of Jerusalem before Titus's army made their assault. But one of the things Jesus also mentions when this has happened, in the upheaval of these days, there's going to be false reports of my return. And begin there looking at those verses that begin in verse 23 and looking down. Jesus basically says to his apostles, when this is all going on, people are going to say that I've returned, but don't believe it. Don't believe those that announce my return. In fact, that's why I'm warning you now, so that you will know false messiahs and false prophets will try to mislead you. He even tells his closest followers here, if you hear that I've returned, don't believe it. And what we see here is Jesus is trying to dissuade them of any notion that this judgment on Jerusalem in AD 70 is going to be some sort of personal, visible coming of the Son of Man. Jesus says, that's not happening. If you even hear it's me, don't believe it. And here's what Jesus said, because you know what? When I come back, you won't have to be told. Jesus says, when I do come back, when the second coming happens, just as lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. I don't know what you think about the second coming, but Jesus' point is when I come back, it's not going to be one of those deals where if somebody doesn't come tell you, you won't know. You're not going to get a phone goes, hey, what's up? Well, oh, Jesus came back? Well, I'm kind of doing something right now. That's not going to be the case. Jesus says, if some people have to come and tell you whatever they think it is, it's not when I come back. Because when I come back, it'll be as obvious and visible as lightning flashing in the sky. And then Jesus makes it clear what I'm talking about here is the end of the nation of Israel. If you look at verse 28, and there's no language that could be used to make it more clear we're talking about the end or the death of something. He says, wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. And if you think about this idea of the death of the nation, it's the death of the nation is any pretense of being God's people. When Jerusalem is destroyed, when the temple is destroyed, now there's no more Levitical records. No one can prove who their descendants are. No one knows who could be a priest. There's no priesthood. There's no temple services. There's no sacrifices. This is a death knell for Judaism. When Jerusalem and the temple is destroyed, as the imagery of vultures perfectly fits. But if you're reading the New King James or the King James, perhaps your verse 8 ends this way. Verse 28. Instead of vultures, it says, the eagles will be gathered together. And again, as a history geek, I find that very interesting. Because, I mean, vultures makes the point, right? This is the death of a nation, and vultures circling would certainly signify that. But it may well be that eagles was intended. Or maybe a better translation. Let me tell you why. If you can't tell what that is, that's an artist's sketch of a Roman legion on the march. I couldn't find any actual photographs, so I had to use a sketch. But do you notice that thing right there in the middle? That's a standard that was very common insignia used by Roman legions. It's an eagle. So as these Roman legions moved, at the head of the column would be a man holding on a large staff, something that looks like the image there on the right side. There's even historical relics that demonstrate these eagles, these standards of Roman legions. So if Jesus had intended them to understand, when you see the eagles gathered, that's where the corpse will be. We have a very somber fulfillment there in the siege of Jerusalem, a siege which Josephus records an estimated 1.1 million Jews died in Titus's assault on the city of Jerusalem. And certainly what we see then in all this is that this is simply divine judgment on Israel. Read verse 29, that's where we are now. Jesus says, but immediately, and immediately is a key word here, I think, too. He says, but immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from the sky and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And you read that language, you can understand, we would come away from this. That sounds like language is talking about the end of the world. That sounds like language that's talking about the end times. Well, let me suggest to you that it's not. It's simply prophetic language for judgment upon a nation. I think you'll see the similarities if we go back and look in the Old Testament, in Isaiah chapter 13, when that prophet talks about the destruction and the downfall of Babylon. Look at the similar language. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be darkened when it rises and the moon will not shed its light. Or when Ezekiel writes of God's coming to judgment on Egypt, he basically says, God says he's going to snuff you out. That's how he talks about God's judgment on Egypt. And when I extinguish you, I will cover the heavens and darken their stars, and I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon will not give its light. All the shining lights in the heavens will darken over you and will set darkness on your land, declares the Lord. And this wasn't the end of the world, but it was the end of the Egyptian world. Kind of like Gary said this morning, kind of depends on where you're standing. But that's the language the prophets used to talk about God coming in judgment against nations, even against his own nation. Joel chapter 2, talking about judgment against Israel. He said, I will display wonders in the sky and on the earth, blood, fire, and columns of smoke. The sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. And it will come about that whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be delivered. And as we read Joel 2 there, you may be saying, hey, that sounds familiar to me. And it probably does, because Peter quotes Joel 2 on Pentecost in his sermon in Acts chapter 2. And if you think about the setting of the day of Pentecost, you realize Peter quotes Joel 2 to do this. Basically, as the church and the kingdom is established, he proclaims the beginning of the end for the Mosaic age and the beginning of the new covenant under the Messiah. So verse 29 is simply language of divine judgment upon a nation. And this time that nation is God's own nation, the nation of Israel. And because it's divine judgment, then in verse 30, Jesus talks about the sign that validates that I am the Son of Man in heaven. Verse 30 reads in the New American Standard this way. It says, and then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. And if you're reading the ESV, it says it this way. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. And what I want to suggest to you is I don't think either one of those are very good translations. Because when you read either one of those, I think that you need to know that's not the original word order. Either one of those translations. But the most common word order we have in these English translations is when you read that, the wording would have people looking in the sky for a sign, right? If you read those translations, that's what you would end up doing. And let me suggest for you that I believe this is one of those places where the influence of premillennialism has impacted the choices the translators made here. Think about it. If you believe that Matthew 24 is talking about the end of time, and you think about when Jesus' actual second coming happens, and you read verses like Revelation 1:7, it says, "Behold, he cometh with the clouds, and every eye shall see him." And so you take that preconceived notion that all this happens at the very end of time. It's all got to be Matthew 24 is talking about Christ's second coming and the end of time. You take that back to Matthew 24, then you might rearrange the words to support what you already believe. But consider that this is the original word order. If you look in your lexicon, or if you even look at the Young's literal translation where they put the words in the exact order they appear, Jesus actually said, "Then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven." Let me suggest to you what I think he's saying is in heaven is not where the sign will be. In heaven is where the Son of Man will be. But then what's going to appear is my sign. And his sign is this divine judgment which he is now prophesying. You see, when Jesus, these 30-some years before this happens, prophesies the destruction of Jerusalem, when that comes to pass, that sign will prove that the Son of Man is the Son of God who has ascended to heaven. And then now we understand why he would use the language in verse 31 of the Son of Man, or the Son coming in judgment. The Son of Man coming in the clouds, if you look at verse 31, is to be understood then in the sense of coming in judgment unto Jerusalem. Not again an invisible personal coming. And just like in the Old Testament, when God judged Egypt, we don't think of God literally, personally, visibly being there, but the language conveys the idea the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and is about to come to Egypt, meaning that he's just coming in judgment. And Jesus uses the same language other places in the book of Matthew in events that are not a personal, visible second coming. In Matthew 16, Jesus speaks in something I think we all will understand as a prophecy of what's going to happen on the day of Pentecost. Jesus says in Matthew 16:28, "There are some of those who are standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Jesus, some of you that are listening to me are going to live to see this. And we understand this is either fulfilled at some time previous or there's some 2,000-year-old people running around somewhere. Then a little later in Matthew, Jesus responding to one of the religious officials. Now, I think his point here is you're going to live to AD 70. And then when you understand divine judgment has come on Jerusalem, then you're going to understand this. Hereafter, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Again, that's just judgment language used in the Old Testament. And used by Jesus himself to describe things other than a personal, visible second coming. And then finally there in verse 31, you see that Jesus says his gospel messengers will draw followers from all nations. And as this section of Matthew 24 kind of draws to a close, we get down to verse 32 and 33 and we see the parable of the fig tree, which I think reinforces this idea we're talking about. Jesus uses now a local sign for a local event. Look at verses 32 and 33. And as we talked about in a class this afternoon, he's sitting there talking to local guys who knew what fig trees were and understood agriculture and these things. So he's giving them something they fully understood. He says, "Now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer's near." That's when you guys understand the fig tree, you know when it's summer. And the apostle goes, "Oh yeah, I get that. I understand. I can tell when it's summer." He says, "So then you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near," right at the door. Jesus' point is these signs will be just as discernible as leaves on the fig tree. And just as clearly as a fig tree can tell you when it's a summer is approaching, when you see these signs, you will know these things are near. In the verse 34 that we mentioned already, Jesus still talking here says, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." Jesus says, look, the things I've been talking about are going to happen during this generation. We're talking about something that's going to happen within the normal contemporary lifespan of you and your appears. And you can take that to the bank. My words will not pass away. So now what Jesus has been talking about, remember the first question was, when is that temple going to be destroyed? When is that building that I pointed out to you this morning, said, look how nice it looks, and you said at one point, there's not going to be one stone left on top of the other. Jesus says within this generation, that's going to be happening. Then my words will come to pass, not one stone here shall be left upon another. It's just you, Jesus has answered their first question. And that temple was destroyed in A.D. 70. When Titus, leading a Roman army, leveled Jerusalem. But very quickly now, Jesus questioned now, exhale. Now verse 36, Jesus thinking, it's now about your second question. And again, I know the apostles didn't realize they asked two questions. But Jesus' response implies that they did, because now he's going to talk about an event for which there will be no warning signs. Because in verse 36, he says, after spending the verse 35 verses telling them you're going to be able to see these signs, you're going to know this happening, and when you see them, you got to do something. You got to get up and run out of Jerusalem. Now he says, there's a day and an hour where no one knows. Not even me, the angels, just my Father. And let me suggest to you, when Jesus does this, verse 36, I would put a circle there. Let me tell you, that's where Jesus switches now and starts talking about his second coming. And the end of time. That day and hour when no one knows. I think the text, the context bears this out a little later in verse 42. He's going to say, therefore be on alert, for you do not know which day the Lord is coming. And as you think about that, let me suggest that that just meshes perfectly with all the other scriptures we have in the New Testament about the second coming. If you go over and read what Paul wrote to the Thessalonians, he says, for you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come just like a thief in the night. Peter wrote and said, but the day of the Lord will come like a thief in which the heavens will pass away. So when that day comes, when the Lord actually comes back and the heavens pass away, Peter says it's going to be like a thief in the night. There aren't going to be discernible signs for you to know. Then as you're looking there in Matthew 24 again, considering that verse 36 is that transition, look where the rest of the chapter goes. And the rest of the things Jesus talks about are examples of the need to be prepared for an event that happens without warning. He goes to the flood and the day of Noah. And really, there's a contrast here. The fig tree was a local example for a local dilemma. Now the flood of Noah, it's a global example for a global event. Because when Christ comes back, the second coming, it doesn't just impact Judea or Jerusalem. And the thing that's different, instead of you seeing these signs coming and doing something about it, whether it's in the day of Noah or what he says next about people working in the field or working at the ground, it's just people going on about their normal routines. People will just be doing those things they do every day, because Jesus himself here says it's going to be like a thief in the night. And then he has the parable about the master's return and the servants not being ready, because he assumes his master is going to take a while for coming. So Jesus has shifted here from warning signs to being ready for something you won't be warned about. And he follows it right up with parables about being ready for an unannounced reckoning. Chapter 24 ends there, but just to kind of, I think, again, reinforce the idea that we're on the right path, if that artificial break in chapter 25 wasn't there, look what he'd be talking about next. Parable of the 10 virgins. The idea of being prepared or unprepared when the bridegroom cometh. Then he goes into the parable of the talents. The idea of a master coming back and a reckoning being made. And then finally in chapter 25, you know, he rolls right into something that makes it very clear. He's talking about final judgment. Chapter 25, verse 31, he says, but when the Son of Man comes in his glory. And we know what he's talking about there. That's the sheep and the goat and the things you all are familiar with. He's talking about a judgment. He's talking about something of eternal consequence, not local temporary consequence like the leveling of Jerusalem. Verse 46, it says, for these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. So, that's a lot. But the key here is, I hope maybe we've helped answer this question. Matthew 24. I don't know if you already had a view on that. I don't know if you just read it. We're kind of wondering what was going on there. I don't know if anything we've talked about has helped clarify that for you, but let me suggest this. We ask the question, was Jesus talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD? Or his second coming at the end of time? And again, we'll ask, well, why does that matter? And we talked about why it matters. Because there's those that twist Matthew 24 and arrive at two different places that are not what Jesus was talking about. Let me suggest to you this, after taking a little closer look here, Jesus is talking about the destruction of the Jerusalem in 70 AD through about verse 35. He's talking about things you can see when you will know it's coming and to get out of Jerusalem. Here's the key. And then Jesus talks about his second coming at the end of time. Beginning there in verse 36 through the rest of 24, really through the rest of chapter 25 as well. Something you have no warning and you have to just be ready. So if we understand what Jesus is teaching in Matthew 24, then hopefully that will help us know when we hear something that isn't what Jesus is teaching in Matthew 24. But even more importantly than that, I think, why does it matter? Because we want to rightly divide Matthew 24. We want to understand what Jesus is teaching because, brethren, those warnings that apply to us, we want to take them to heart. We don't want to understand that he's going to come back like a thief in the night. And we want nothing more than to be ready for his second coming. What about you tonight? Are you ready for his second coming? Are you ready for that day and the hour of which no one knows? You are if you're a Christian. Do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God? Do you believe that he came to this earth and lived a sinless life and then willingly died for your sins? And if you believe that, are you willing to confess it? Would you publicly confess and profess through your life your faith in Jesus Christ? And then would you repent of that sin, turn away from it, be baptized in water for forgiveness of that sin, and then be raised to walk in newness of life as one of his children? If you're subject to the invitation tonight, we do anything to help you. Let us know by coming forward now while we stand and while we sing.